Welcome to the Real Life Fishing Podcast. I'm the host, Jimmy Easterling, also a go by Coachy. And today we have a special guest. We have a more of a celebrity, I guess you can say, for the show. If you're a new first time listener, this podcast, we talk to anglers, and so far they most of them been from Arkansas, but I'm gonna, venture out. But we talk about fishing, but mainly, guys, we talk about life. I want to get into the lives of these anglers and mainly just to kind of let people get to hear the stories, get to know them better. And if you've checked out the other episodes, I have a bunch of people that have followed and listened to them all, but if you're new to it, we just want to get into life, and I have a lot of Arkansas anglers on the podcast. I want this to be the biggest Arkansas fishing podcast in this state, and we're getting there. We're getting there. It's not going to be easy. It takes all you listeners from sharing, from talking to your friends about it. Appreciate every one of you that have. But guys, this guest today, I mean, he is right now one of the biggest. He's a big influencer, big angler. I don't know what to say in the world of fishing right now. He's been on so many podcasts lately, but they've been forward facing sonar talks. It's been why to ban the live scope, why not to ban the live scope, debates. Guys, this is not about to be a debate podcast. This is about to be me and Randy having a conversation. We go over a bunch of topics. Randy shares some pretty sweet stories. He gets into how he got into the YouTube scene, how he came about. He even said he was late to it, which in a way he was, but he got in at the right time for him to kind of go and grow and build his brand. Man, he shared some other unique stories throughout the way with the tournament trails, how stuff changed. Guys, and then even at the end of the podcast, he gets deep on something then, and I've heard of the story before, but for Randy to share it again and for him to relive it, it's not easy. So guys, appreciate you all checking us out. I'm excited about this one, really am. And how this podcast went is almost how I wanted it. Like I say, almost it was. We talked about forward facing sonar just a little bit, but that was me bringing up to him how he opened my eyes on things. Okay. Now, guys, just so you know, I use it. I have fun fishing with the live scope. But as Randy said, we can still be friends. He is not against people, against you. He's not against me using it. He's against the tournament trails and just how the future of it's going with the technology. We talked about that with the limitations and stuff, guys. But more importantly, this podcast, we go deep into some conversations. I mean, it was great. And guys, so appreciate it. Now, I know also normally in my intro, I talk about tournaments and what's kind of gone on. Guys, in Arkansas right now, it's been dang snowing. Last time I did a podcast a week ago, there's not been any tournaments since. All the tournaments were moved to the next weekend. My guys at Fish Lake Hamilton are fishing a tournament. You're going to be at Hamilton next weekend. There's like eight tournaments in Hamilton. Maybe not eight, but there's at least four or five. Poor Lake Hamilton. I want to go, get on back on Ouachita, but, I mainly to Gray. Guys, on that last fishing trip, and guys, on my Fishing Coach YouTube channel, my personal one, we had a DeGray trip recently. It was early in the month. And dude, like, I want to get back out there. Those fish haven't seen a lure. It's like nobody's fishing for them right now. So I want to get back out there. And guys, and once again, I didn't mention this earlier, I have a unique relationship with Randy. I'm looking at the podcast right now as it's playing, and I kind of want to bring it up. I have a unique relationship with Randy. I work with him through Fish the Moment, Bass Fishing Declassified YouTube channel, which is a channel that I run through Fish the Moment. It's a Fish the Moment channel, but I'm the editor for it. I edit for Fish the Moment as well. Johnny, always has a part in his videos. So we work together, and I, of course, that's why he hired me. But I do the Bass Fishing Declassified solo, and we have a bunch of different anglers on there. Randy is one of them. So there'll be videos where I give a tip, and then Randy gives a tip. So I talk to Randy weekly at times. I talk to him 2-3 times a week. So I have a unique relationship with Randy. But anyway, guys, appreciate it. I know I like to ramble and talk. Like I said, not much has happened in the last week. Typically, we do this podcast 2 times a month, but right now, and they're like 2 weeks in between, but right now we've gone back to back. I have more lined up, and I might be, man, kind of my schedule is getting kind of tight, so I might just start pumping more out than than I typically would. So guys, appreciate it again. Now this podcast is brought to you by Future Marine. Future Marine is your number one dealer in the state of Arkansas, and I believe they just hit another top 10 in the country. Guys, I'm happy to be partnered with Future Marine. And of course, they're not just in the fishing business, guys. They have expanded the pontoon world, the wake boat world. I talked to a guy last night, and he was like, dude, I want a wake boat. And I was like, well, hey, Future Marine has a few, you know. So whatever your boating needs are, Future Marine can serve you. And like I said, the biggest thing about them to me is they're a family business, third-generation family business. I'm all about working with family businesses. I have a couple others I'm looking to partner with in the future as well. I'm not going to announce those yet. I got to get some stuff done. But they're all family businesses as well. So, guys, enough of me rambling. Let's go get into the podcast. Randy, man, I appreciate you being on today. And you just said you're at a bait works right now. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm actually, they have a wrap shop here. So I'm getting my truck wrapped. They're finishing up the front of it right now. So hanging out over here right now.
So, hey, how long have you been with bait works?
Well, you know, I'm not with them anymore. You know, we were with them for 2 years, but now I'm working with Tackle Warehouse. They just had some opportunities to move in that direction, but no, Bait Works is great, man. They're a great company and everything. You know, no hard feelings with it. Just had a sort of a better fit with Tackle Warehouse, so we're working over there now. But Bait Works, they've got a wrap shop here, you know, right here at the shop here in Springfield.
Awesome. That's right. That's right. So, yeah, you're getting your truck wrapped. So Tackle Warehouse, I tried to reach out to them to kind of get a little thing going. I got info, you know, from somebody that you might have got it from. And I think Tackle Warehouse told me I'm not big enough yet. So I got paired with Fish USA on an affiliate link. But maybe one day I'll get to Tackle Warehouse status.
Dang, because you've got like 40,000 on Bass Fishing Declassified now, isn't it?
Yeah, we're 36, 36, and then on mine's growing. But and like on mine, like I just started mine, you know, the thing that's interesting on my YouTube channel is I'm the biggest YouTuber in Central Arkansas. Like Hot Springs, which is a big fishing. Now, I know there's professionals, but they don't do the social media side. And so right. I guess not big enough for Tackle Warehouse, though. But anyway, and they might know that you're on it. You know, you and Matt are both on it. Mm-hmm. So talking about the YouTube, you first, I don't know, did you have your channel before Fish the Moment? Or did Fish the Moment bring you on and then you got it going? Explain how all that kind of got started.
I had started, actually, how it initially got started first time is I was talking to David Dudley. God, this has been probably 5 years ago or so. And he told me that he was, he had a YouTube channel and he was doing videos. And I think he had like, you know, 25 or 30,000 subscribers at the time. And he goes, yeah, he goes, I'm making like $500 a month off of YouTube. And he goes, it's more work than it's worth it. So I don't think I'm going to do it anymore. And I said, we're making $500 a month, you know, just doing videos. And he goes, yeah, but, you know, he put a lot of time into the editing. So I got, you know, at the time I said, I got to try to figure out how to do something to bring some more value to my sponsors. Because all I had was Facebook and Instagram. So I started up a YouTube channel. This was a little bit before Johnny and I started working together, and I had a GoPro at the time. I didn't know what I was doing at all. So I just like tried to do some tournament videos and this and that. And I put a few of them up and nobody watched them at all. And this was, I think I posted my first video, my first YouTube video in 2020, sometime during 2020, the early part of 2020. And, nobody was watching them, and I couldn't ever get the GoPro to work. It would always freeze up on me, and I couldn't. It was just a big hassle. So I just said, man, I'm just going to try to film some videos at my house with my cell phone. So I started just filming in my tackle room at the house with my cell phone, you know, how to, you know, bait tips and modifications. And people started watching them, and more people started watching them, and it started growing, you know, with the cell phone, the simple cell phone deal, because a lot of people, nobody was doing that at the time. Everybody had music and drones and highly edited stuff, but I was the only one out there that just had this bare bones, and that's because I didn't know how to do anything else. And then Johnny and I started working together, I think it was the early spring of 2020, and then Johnny helped expose my channel, gave me, and once Johnny started pushing my channel through Fish the Moment, it really took off. So Johnny's is really responsible for where I'm at today. I mean, he really got me off the ground. And then it was sort of the perfect timing because I went through that first year and then we had the COVID shutdown and lockdown. And during that period, everybody was watching videos because nobody could do anything else. So it really, really exploded during the whole COVID period. I mean, there was one period there where I was getting like 5,000 new subscribers a month. I mean, it was just booming, you know, and obviously, and as COVID went through and you know, then it went down from there. But that's sort of how it got started with that progression. But yeah, Johnny's a bigger. It was, you know, and like I said, if it wasn't for Johnny, there's no way I could have got off the ground like that. I mean, I owe most of that to him for sure. Because mm-hmm. when Johnny and I started working together, he had like 50,000 subscribers at the time we first started working together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so he's grown quite a bit from now because he's got. What has he got? 150, 180,000 subscribers now?
He's at 160. Yeah. What's crazy, and I know we have a little bit of a lag, and I'll try to let you finish and stuff. But I remember, so like Johnny, when he went full time, was right before COVID. It was that winter before COVID hit. And we always talked, you know, we talked, we fished as much as we could, being where we're kind of far, where we moved apart because he was in Fayetteville. I was down in mm-hmm. Arkadelphia, Central Arkansas before I moved it further south. But I still remember him calling me after a Table Rock fishing trip that he went and filmed and edited. He first told me how he caught him, which was typical. If he got on something cool, he's calling me on the way home. Like even when he made his first live scope video, he called me after that and was like, dude, I got it. I'm about to have the sweetest live scope video out there, which, you know, with what he does with electronics and all is crazy.
Oh, yeah,
with all this stuff. And so, but on that Table Rock trip, I remember him telling me going back to the Table Rock in that spring, he's like, dude, I just saw Randy Blockett at the ramp. I think I'm going to bring him on. What do you think? And I was like, what? And, you know, I grew up watching, you know, I grew up watching the professional tournaments. I grew up all this. I was a student of it. And I remember when I got in it, I knew Randy Blockett. I knew a little bit of the history because I'd loved the history stuff. I knew you were like considered an outlaw. You were considered a bad dude. You did all this crazy stuff in boats. And then when Johnny, which he knew more people in the industry, when Johnny was like, I'm about to bring on Randy, I was like, dude, Johnny, Randy's the opposite of you, right? You're an electronics guy. He's the older angler, shallow water. And he's like, Jimmy, that's it. We're opposites. And he's going to bring value. I was like, dude, sweet. You know, but wasn't that like a fishing, like you met him at the ramp, right? Like y'all ran into each other at the ramp, not seeing each other in how many years?
Yeah, I had a guide trip down there and we came off the water. When I launched my boat, you know, I didn't know, I hadn't seen Johnny in, God, it had been 5 or 8 years. I mean, I used to see him regularly at the tournaments when his mom and dad would bring me to the tournaments, but I hadn't seen him forever. And then we were taking the boat out, you know, once I got out and Johnny came in and it's like, God dang, there he is. You know, and we started talking and just, you know, he was telling me what he had going on with the YouTube. And, you know, that's how we got hooked back up, you know, doing the lake map breakdowns eventually and working with Fish the Moment, doing the, you know, the challenges on the water and all that type of stuff. I've known Johnny since he was 8 years old. His mom and dad brought him down to one of the Bassmaster Classics I was in. I can't remember which one it is. And, you know, that's where we met down there. And then over the course of the years, his dad would call me, you know, every 2 or 3 months, you know, for, you know, try to get some fishing advice for Johnny because Johnny was wanting to learn. So, you know, we kept in contact over the years like that. But yeah, Johnny knew more at 8 years old than most pros do now. He was like one of those, you know, geniuses. Like, you know, if you ever watched the TV show Young Sheldon, about how Sheldon is a genius, that was Johnny with fishing when he was 8. It was like unbelievable. He could literally carry on a conversation like high level tournament talk at 8. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and that's what that's what it was neat with me and him. When I met him, he did the whole junior bass fishing. Like you said, you met him in eight. I somehow got brought into this junior bass circuit in Arkansas. I was like the only one at the time, way before high school fishing was a thought, college. And I showed up to this event, and already like all my buddies, and this is just how I was gonna ask you too, but all my buddies talked about Johnny from where I went to school, but they all were kind of like jealous of him. And they would probably tell you that now. They're mature now to say like we were kids, they were jealous. And because Johnny would come in and do good in the tournaments. He was considered a nerd, like you just said, young Sheldon. He had his glasses, his, you know, just his persona about him. And the thing about me was I grew up in a rough environment, rough house, whatever. But, dude, I love school. I was kind of like a nerd. I mean, I have a mathematics degree. So, like, anyway, so when I met Johnny, like, something clicked. I was like, hey, we're opposites, but we both kind of have, you know. But then, you know, once that first tournament that I fished, now how these junior bass tournaments worked, dude, we showed up. We were put in people's boats. We made decisions or they would drive us. But, like, we had to catch five bass. Like, if there's three kids in a boat, each one of us had to catch five. So I showed up to Lake Darnell, never been there, no idea. It was a 15-inch slot. I caught two fish on the day. Johnny had three, and he had like 2 or 3 ounces more than me. And so I got second. And he right then was like, hey, I got some new competition. And so he would start talking to me after the tournament, how'd you catch him, picking my brain. And I'm over here like, dude, this dude knows a lot more about fishing than I do. Like, I just knew it. And we're like 3 or 4 years. I don't know how far we are apart. But that was, I was like, hey, I want to kind of be friends with this guy. Me and him might gel, fish together. We don't go to the same school, high school at the time. So it's pretty crazy to where we're at now. Now, I know you kind of talked to me. When was the first time you saw Johnny? It was at the Classic, right? Was that the first time?
Yeah, it was at the Classic. Johnny probably remembers. When was that? It was like, I can't remember if it was at the Louisiana Delta or Lake Wiley. God, I can't remember, man. But it's been a long time ago. Because what, Johnny's 25 now or something, 27?
Dude, he might be 28. That's why I don't know. We're getting older.
So, well, yeah, 20 years ago or so, something like that. And then, you know, they came to several tournaments, you know, throughout the course of the years after that and everything. But
man, I was, yeah,
it was, you know what?
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, go ahead. One of the most, you know, impressive things about fishing with Johnny, you know, like I said, you find out real quick if they're full of BS or if they're real deal. And those challenges that we did, he beat me in 90% of them. And it's like, you know, I realized at the time that he is just on another level, you know, at what he does, and especially like, you know, with his knowledge of how he reads 2D sonar. He can look at 2D sonar and he can adjust it and he can see things and show things I didn't even know were there. I mean, he can make his 2D sonar do so much stuff that most people are even unaware that people can do. I mean, he can do things with 2D sonar that, you know, it takes people down imaging, side imaging, live imaging to do. I mean, his ability with electronics is just on a completely different level.
My little one just tried to walk in the room.
Oh, I heard somebody coming in. I know how that goes. Yeah.
Yeah, man. No, you're right on the 2D. He said it on a BTL last week with Matt Pangrick. I think last week they were talking about live scope, and Johnny was like, hey, I've caught the individual fish. I've done this with it, that. He goes, I'd rather just use my 2D sonar and down imaging and find these fish and catch them without it. He's like, and it was interesting for him to say it. But that 2D, I got to watch him when I was younger get good at that 2D. I always got to be in the boat. Mm-hmm. His parents, he has that old Triton that he still has, but he had that Hummingbird. He did get a Hummingbird before, or it was like at the time, maybe the second nicest Hummingbird. And I'll go fish with him. And our whole thing was we would go fish shallow and catch fish, but he would then, you know, he was already watching and studying. and was like, hey, let's go out here and try to find him. And I just got to sit there and watch it. You know, he'd be idling. Hey, what do you think this is? And pointing at stuff. And I'm like, dude, it's a dot. I don't know. And, you know, but he would go and find out if it was rock, throw a jig to see if it's rock. He was doing the whole feel cranking. And so it was cool for me to kind of watch it and be a part of it. Now, I'm not, you know, he still tells me when he started making content is when he really stepped his game up with all that too, you know. So it was a it's a lot, man. But I know for you, that's what I was going to get to. You, the thing I know when I hear your story, Johnny's story, and kind of mine, you gave Johnny time as a professional angler. You talked to him. You listened to him when he was a kid. And he remembered all that. And so you put an impression on him. You put a positive, positive, I guess, light on him, even for him to invite you to the YouTube stuff. Because there's a lot of pros out there. You know, Johnny even told me guys' names at those classics, at events. He would try to talk to, and those pros would just get out of my way. I'm big time, you know, or just, hey, nice to meet you. But it was good to hear, you know, there are pros that give people their time. But that's what I think for you, you gave him your time, and that's when, you know, it, look where we are now. So just well, your thoughts on that.
I remember back when I was a kid, I was like Johnny. I just, I mean, he started younger than I did, but I started really getting interested in fishing when I was about 12. And it's the same deal. It's like if I went at, like to a seminar or something and there was a pro there, I was so nervous about approaching them. And I understand what it's like to just be ate up with it. And then you want the people that you've watched in tournament fishing, you want them to live up to your expectations. I got a pretty cool story for you. I was the very first seminar I ever went to. I was like 15 years old, and my mom and dad drove me down. There was a seminar down in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It was like the Okie Bug seminar. And this was back in like 1975. And there were guys like, you know, Ricky Green was there. I think Roland Martin, this was, you know, Bill Nance, those type of guys. And Ricky Green, this was back, a lot of people may not know who Ricky Green is, but he's qualified for 13 Bassmaster Classics. He used to be a hammer back in the day. And anyway, I went up to him and I knew him who he was from the Bassmaster Classic. And he goes, yeah, he goes, I need to take a break. Let's go out and we'll talk a little bit. So he took me out like in the outside of the Coliseum out there, and he pulled a pint of Jack Daniel's whiskey out. And he started drinking the whiskey, and he goes, man, what do you want to know? He goes, I'll tell you anything. So I sit there for a half hour and talk to him about fishing while he's sipping on some Jack Daniels, and he went back in for the seminar and stuff like that.
Hey, that story is wonderful for what, like, this podcast is. So like I mentioned earlier, this is for Arkansas anglers. I have a lot of Arkansas people that listen. And, you know, when you said Ricky Green, I was like, time out. I believe that's the Ricky Green I know. I don't know him personally like that.
Yeah, Arkadelphia, Arkansas.
Arkadelphia, yeah. Yes, sir. So his son still kind of does the tournaments or runs tournaments and stuff. So, man,
His son, Keith, used to fish the FLW Tour. You know, so did Ricky, but Keith fished it even after that.
Yeah, that's great. So, hey, you said you're, you know, 15 years old. You went to a seminar, which is wow. But when you were young, I guess who's your biggest influence before you got into the tournaments? Like who, I mean, was it your dad, grandpa, or was it a professional or a local angler? Who was that big influence?
I didn't, you know, my dad, we had like a 16-foot Starcraft with a trolling motor and a 28-horse motor on it. And he'd take me fishing maybe four or five times a year down to Table Rock or Grand Lake. And, you know, he liked to fish with him and a friend of his, and they'd take me. So dad and our friend, we'd all go, the three of us, but we'd only go three or four times a year. It'd have to be perfect conditions, like at 70 degrees and, you know, just nice conditions. So I didn't really have, you know, my dad got me interested in it. But the thing that really got me interested in it, just wading creeks when I was a little kid in school at the bottom of my mom and dad's house. I started catching bass down there. And then I got a subscription to Bassmaster magazine when I was in grade school, and I started the tournament end of. They used to have a thing called On the Tournament Trail, the Bassmaster magazine, and that whole thing about On the Tournament Trail just captivated me. It's like that's the only thing I wanted to read in Bassmaster was the Tournament Trail. I knew every pro. I knew where they were from. I knew everything about them. I knew their name of their wife. I knew everything about them. And I never did get a chance to, you know, fish around any of them like that. But the thing that really got me turned around is I was, for my initial drive, I was down at Grand Lake in 1982. And my mom and dad had we had a trailer house down there by Sobo Bridge at Grand, which is about 35 miles from Joplin there. So we'd go down every weekend, this little, you know, mom and pop resort with our trailer house. And there was a tournament going out of Red 11 Port, which was close to where we were staying there. And one of the guy that won the tournament had 28 pounds, flipping willow trees. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't even know what flipping was at the time. And I asked him, I go, how did you catch 28 pounds? And his name was Terry Thomas, a legend here in the Ozarks. And he goes, well, why don't you come tomorrow? And there's a tournament tomorrow, a little buddy tournament. Let's go fish it. So Terry didn't know me. He took me out the next day of the tournament. We won the tournament with 28 pounds flipping willows. And that was my biggest influence. He became my mentor. You know, I sort of adopted his style of fishing. And just early on, that's what got me into it, you know, to actually propel me into fishing tournaments.
Wow, that's awesome, man. That's a flipping willow trees catching 28 pounds. I've never done that before. I bet that was a blast back then,
too. I only caught one. I caught a 2-pounder. Terry caught all the rest of them. He had a 1/2-ounce black jig and number one pork frog, 30-pound test, high visibility strand line. And I had like a little 1/4-ounce jig with 15-pound green maxima. I was totally unprepared for it. And I got out there. This is how much I didn't know. I remember looking at Terry's rig, and I go, he's got 30-pound test, glow-in-the-dark blue line. He's never going to catch nothing. I'm going to catch a bunch with this invisible maxima line. He waxed me. It's like I realized at the time. I went out the next week and bought me a spool, a 30-pound clear blue strand. And I used it for the next 10 years flipping on there.
So he influence you fished with him. Now, when you started doing tournaments, did you still come back and fish with him? Was he still there to kind of teach you techniques? How did that relationship go?
We fished buddy tournaments together here and there up until when I started fishing it was the old Red Man's back then. They're called the BFLs now, in 1984. Yeah. And after that, we didn't fish together much because he was fishing the tournaments too. But I got real fortunate and qualified for the All-American my first year in 84, and that's sort of what got me my first boat sponsorship with Ranger and sort of got me to be sort of like a real tournament fisherman at that time.
Yeah. So as you're getting in the tournaments and you're starting to get, you know, I guess making some money and you're going, when did that outlaw – like, I don't know, attitude or persona, the whole gas tanks deal, putting gas tanks on the bank, chopping trees. How did that come about? Like, I mean, I hear that stuff and I think it's just awesome that but you can't do it anymore. I know, but I think it's so cool to hear those stories.
Well, that's how I used to fish down at Grand Lake because, you know, I was down at Grand Lake every weekend for 20 years, you know, fishing down there. And one of the things I liked to do at Grand back then and there is I would go to every single creek on the lake and I would try to get my boat as far up that creek as I could. And at the time I had a little aluminum boat, like a 16-foot aluminum, and I'd catch fish doing that. So I took that same philosophy out on the circuit, and there was a period from about 1988 to probably 96 or 97 where every tournament I went to, I tried to access, I'd look at a map and I'd find every creek on the lake. And in practice, I would go as far up every creek as I could go, trying to access places people would never get their boat into. And it paid off. And it didn't pay off every time, but, you know, it paid off enough for me to make a living in the sport for 10 years. And then also there was a period of time there back in that early to mid 90s that Gary Klein and I were working together, you know, quite a bit in the tournaments, and Gary sort of had that same mindset. He liked that whole idea of doing stuff off the wall and getting into hard to reach areas and trying to, you know, push the envelope into that thing. And so there was about a 5-year period there where I really went all out in it. I mean, I tried to jump. I did not try. I did jump mud flats, dig ditches out to try to run through channels, had my chainsaw with me, you know, look for those type of areas specifically. And that, like I said, it paid off in some of them there, but that was back then. You can't, those areas are no good anymore. That was like a different time and place, you know, that period.
Yeah, that and stuff gets silted in.
Yeah, and here's another thing at the time. Back then, it was completely different with the service crews. You know, we back in the 80s and 90s, all the service crews showed up at the tournaments. And like, for example, one year with Mercury, I trashed 6 lower units as far as where I knocked my lower unit off or I bent prop shafts trying to get into hard-to-reach areas. And Mercury would replace them for free. They wouldn't charge anything. That's just – that's that they were there to service the anglers. And I remember one year I knocked off 6 lower units, either the knocked them off where they had to be replaced. And then they changed it a couple years later and you had to pay for everything. So that's one reason that changed my approach, because I couldn't afford to tear my stuff up like I did before. Not that I intentionally tried to tear it up, but when you're running across a mud flat, a 6-inch deep mud flat for 100 yards, you know, you're going to tear some stuff up. Or if you're in the back of a creek and you've got to jump log jams or, you know, or get through whatever, you know, it's hard on a boat, man. That's
it's very hard. And I know like some of those areas, like there's a lake where the lake I was just living by before I moved back to Hot Springs, it's so silted you can't get in some areas like you used to. But there is like, and I know some guys, I'm not gonna say their name, there's two dudes, they have an aluminum boat, maybe one graph, I don't know. But they won a lot of money this year on a smaller lake somewhere in Arkansas where they were getting that boat to where we couldn't take my boat or your boat. And they, it's like that old school approach. And they one day sent me pictures of fish they're catching and they sent me the pin. And I'm like, dude, I'm like, dude, how did you get there? Like, here's the lake and they're way up here. They just took that thing in a creek and, you know, the whole ditches digging and stuff. And they were winning money in tournaments. And it was just cool that people still do it, but it's Poche's doing it or trying to do it. And he's been successful with it at the top level. But it is really, really, yeah, like you said, equipment's expensive. That lower unit is $6,000 to $8,000.
Oh yeah. And you can't do it anymore, because one of the reasons I got out of it is every year they started making the boats bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, the boat that I had for several years, I used to run a Ranger 340, which was a 16.5 foot, you know, long boat with a 150 on it. And then I went to the Ranger 350s for years, which was a 17-foot boat. And now all the boats are 20, 21 feet with 250s on them, and they're 1,000 pounds heavier. And you can't push them around like you used to. You used to be able, those old Ranger 350s used to be able to get out of the boat and move them around and push them around. You can't do that now. Their boats are too big. And too expensive, right. You know.
Too expensive, that is right. Hey, I want to move the conversation now, and we're going to go back to some tournament talk, because I have an interesting question too on the tournament talk. But like YouTube and the presence of social media, the change of the tournaments, because you got on the YouTube a little early, as we just talked, and you saw that as a way to give your sponsors a reward, not a reward. Give them their value. That's it. So, yeah. Like, did you see that happening? And if you did, I mean, you probably did. But where it's at today, or did you think it happened too late, or is it happening fast? Because in the last year, how many people have a YouTube channel now? I mean, it's crazy. But even the tournaments, Bass, MLF, NPFL, they say their views are up. I don't know. I want to see the statistics. I'm not going to lie. Like, I want to see the paper. Like of it, because I don't know as many people that watch like tournaments. Like if they do, they're my age or older. Them kids don't watch it, and I'm around them kids more than a lot of people. Just your thoughts on how this shift has happened so fast in the last 2-3 years.
Well, I got in really late in the game, because if you look at most of the really big bass fishing YouTubers, the guys that have over 200,000 followers, those were the guys that got in a long time ago. They got in like. Yeah. 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, and it was a lot easier to get subscribers back then because there was not any content out there. So most of these guys that you see that have these really big followings, they got in early the game. if you got in like I did anytime after 2020, 2020, 2021, it is extremely difficult to get YouTube followers because there's such a saturation in the market. I mean, for example, you know, your Bass Fishing Declassified channel out there, that has a tremendous number of subscribers considering how late that channel was created. If you look at, you know, the relationship between other channels, it is extremely, extremely difficult now to get into the YouTube world of bass fishing and get a big following simply because there's so many people out there doing it. And on top of that, there's so much content that overlaps. It's like you can only, somebody can only tell you so many times how to fish a chatterbait or how many, you know, modifications you can do with the fluke. And everyone does that over and over again. So that's why, like YouTube now, it's such a challenge to constantly create interesting content. And that's why you see like the opinion videos are so much more successful, or the podcasts like we're doing here, because that human interest aspect of YouTube is something that never, you know, goes away, but the tips and techniques do. So I've seen a big transition in my own YouTube channel where the actual fishing tips, and I've watched other guys too on their fishing tip videos. They just don't pull the views like they used to. They really don't. There's been a tremendous decline just in the last 2 years of it. And that's why Johnny and I have talked about this before. It's like you constantly got to stay one step ahead of the game and try new stuff and throw new stuff out there to get people to hit on it. So if that answers your question, or maybe I got sidetracked there.
No, you're good. Yeah, I'm with you. It's saturated right now, and it is. And after 2021, I told my father-in-law, and he's a business guy. He's done different business avenues. And I told him, I think right now we're in the stage of who hangs in there will seek, you know, some a gain, because so many people are doing it. And you know it's hard. Like, you do 40 videos a week. I don't know, so many videos. And and like, even when I do 3 to 4 videos a week on my channel, 1 or 2 on Declassified, that takes time. Mm-hmm. And I think these people doing it that aren't getting the views, are they going to last? And so yeah. I think we're in that stage of just hanging in there. And then over time, people will drop out. But it's interesting, though, like with the tournament side, like Bassmaster, MLF, and all of them, like, MLF had it going great with their original format. People were watching. And then, you know, it's all here we are now. But I think it's interesting that, like, some of the pros were ahead and they have their YouTube channel. Some still don't. And, like, I'll share it with you. Like, this last year, and I've told this to other people, and some people don't believe me, but it's the truth. At my high school fishing club meeting, now this was in summer 2023, I don't know, fall 2023, I had 20 kids in there, okay? Now, I had a fishing team also in 2016-17, okay? So I can compare the generation differences. But this last year, I always had baits, tackle, shirts to give away. And my question was, guys, who is the Arkansas angler that got DQ'd from an event and is right now the biggest talk in professional fishing? They all stared at me. And I was like, you got to be kidding me. And all the dads know it's Spencer Shuffield. They're all over here waving their hand. And I picked Arkansas anglers. Like, I was like, hey, these are kids from an hour from Hot Springs, you know, Arkansas anglers. And then I said, can y'all name me another Arkansas angler besides Stetson Blaylock? They all knew Stetson because he came to an event me and him did together talking about electronics. Those kids couldn't name another Arkansas angler. See, and I was just over here. I was over here like, what's going on?
Yeah.
Now let's go back to 2016-17, a team in a different county, whatever, different kids. I couldn't come up with questions hard enough for them to answer. Like, they would boom, boom, boom. I mean, they would tell me who won this event on this day, and it's changed, but it's changed because of YouTube. Yeah. Is and like, you know, they watch your videos, they watch my videos, they watch Johnny's or, you know, Guggen Squad. They know Jacob Wheeler from his YouTube channel. They couldn't tell you that he won that Gunnersville event this year on the Freeloader, but they know what the Freeloader is because it's on a YouTube channel. You know, it's, yeah. But that shift, that shifts change. And I finally heard James Watson. He said it on a podcast. He went to a big event, high school, college kids, and only like four dudes knew who he was. And I was just like, wow. it's a change. It's crazy.
The newer anglers, they do not have any history, knowledge of the sport whatsoever. The last ICAST I went to down there in Orlando was, maybe 2019 or something like that. We were standing around a group, and Luke Clawson was there. There was like 10 of us standing around, and this group of kids came up, and they were wanting autographs from different people. And anyway, at the time, this one Guggen Squad guy came through there. I can't remember which one it was. But anyway, they saw this guy coming down here, and he came over in our group, and they were wanting some autographs, and all they wanted to do was get their autograph from this, Guggen Squad guys. And one of the guys in the group says, "Hey, you want Luke's autograph? You know, who's won the Bassmaster Classic and the Forster Cup?" They didn't even know who he was. They did not know who Luke Clawson was, yet they knew who this, Guggen Squad YouTuber. That's the world we find ourselves in now.
Yes,
there's a bunch of guys out there that don't even know who Roland Martin is right now.
Yeah, it's true. That's true. The Bassmaster had that TV show. It's on Fox Sports. They're going over the history right now. I just went blank on the name. Called The Cast.
I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I sent that to a couple of my young kids' dads. I'm like, hey, you need to watch this, and then you need to make your kid watch this. This is great.
Yeah.
Some good stuff. And that last one that I watched, it might have been the newest episode. I don't know where I'm at. But it was Bill Dance at an event, and he got second. I don't know if it was the classic or what. It might have been the classic. He got second. The dude that won was a smaller federation guy. And Dance was just at the time, devastated. He thought he had it won. All that. I know you've been there in these situations where you've gotten second. And so Bill was just hurt. But then he found out the guy that won, that dude needed that money so bad. His wife was having like medical bills. They were like, really broke. And Bill, mm-hmm. after he found that out, was just like, hey, everything happens for a reason.
Right.
Cool part of that, that deal. Now, hey, I just brought up an older guy, older guy. You've talked about, and I know other people might have talked about it, but you brought to my attention on like, hey, we need to have the circuit for the older anglers. Like there's an age to where, you decline.
Senior.
The senior circuit. Yes. Hey, the senior circuit. Cause like golf does it and like football and all that. Yeah. But like, I think the senior circuit would be a hit. I really do.
Oh, absolutely. I guarantee if you had a senior circuit over 50 and you had all the guys out there like Biffle and, everyone that's over 50 out there, make it an old school over 50 circuit out there, it would get more viewership than the current Elite Series. Absolutely. No doubt whatsoever in my mind.
It goes back to what, like I just said with the kids, them guys that are still watching the elites watched you guys, and I think the senior circuit, and not even just like would like it don't have to be nine events. I mean, it could be four or five. But one thing I thought was interesting, like I knew this happened, but I forgot. Right, like that old Mega Bucks tournament where like y'all got put on lakes.
Yep.
And there was six holes or periods. You could fish a place in 50 mm-hmm. minutes. Like, that makes stuff interesting. If that was happening today, people would watch.
I don't know why they still don't do stuff like that. They just – everybody has a different agenda that has owned Bassmaster, that thinks is, profitable or not. So it's just – doesn't make sense at times. So.
Yeah, but like my memory coming back to the Mega Bucks, and I'll say it, I don't care. Like, I'm about to make, I have it because it's snowing outside, but I got like on my list of content to try to do for my channel. I want to like go to a lake and go to different sections and fish it for an hour and make mm-hmm. videos. And I think, just to see if that kind of gets some, different interest in it, you're moving around, but that's hard. Like, that mm-hmm. really is hard. And so, like, I don't know if they anyway, I think a senior circuit would be a hit, have challenges.
I don't, I don't understand why nobody has made that happen. I mean, it's just, it's such a well-received idea, and there's so much interest on so many different levels that, you know, I don't get it. You know, as far as pulling ratings and television time and, you know, appealing to a demographic that has a lot of discretionary income, because you figure the biggest discretionary income age bracket is sort of like that 40 to 60. And if you that have the can spend money on tackle, and if you can put those type of guys up there, it just makes sense. But somebody doesn't think it's a good idea, I guess.
Hey, do you buy lottery tickets? I know you always make a joke. If I win the lottery, I'm going to start a league. Like, do you actually buy lottery tickets, or is that? I make jokes all the time.
if they get one up there that's like 800 million or a billion, yeah. I'll buy one occasionally like that, because like, what the heck? You know, if you don't play, you're never going to win. It's like, But yeah, I've never won anything in the lottery ever.
Yeah. I always make the jokes like around my friends, like, hey, if I win the lottery, I'm doing this. But then I always like, dude, I never buy a ticket. But like, I know when it gets real high, I'm over here like, hey, I probably need to go try, you know, somehow win that 300.
I'm going to keep doing that. And I'll tell you the first thing I'm going to do. And I don't, like I said, I don't mean to, a little bit on the live scope here. I don't have anything against guys that use live scope. I love Johnny Schultz more than anybody in the world. He likes live scope. I don't have anything against that. It's the bigger picture for me. But again, if I win that lottery, I'm driving down to Alabama. I'm going to that office and say, here's $5 million. This is what we're going to do. And the next day it's going to be 2D sonar only.
Oh, that would be great. Hey, and on that, so, and I don't know, I know a lot of people are probably going to be like, hey, let's talk live scope. I was going to share, I already told you, I was going to share how you opened my eyes. You know, like you said, hey, we're friends. We work together. I use it. My YouTube channel, I have videos of me breaking down live scope footage. Mm-hmm. Part of that teaching, part of that of, hey, nobody's doing it and I'm trying to do something different. But you opened my eyes when I met you in person. In August, when we were at Table Rock 2022, when, you know, you just got done with your Mercer podcast, it didn't come out yet. It came out on my way home. And that podcast, I thought, out of all the ones you've been on, was probably the best. Like, you and Mercer, that was a good one. But before that podcast came out, we were just talking throughout the week of hanging out, working. You opened my eyes on how sports have limitations. And I was a football coach. I mean, I have a box full of championship rings right here. I got footballs over here from great teams. And I played baseball. I mean, I've done it all, track. And I was like, wow, sports do have limitations. Like, one thing, I grew up literally in the baseball or the college, not college. I was still 16, 15 or so. The aluminum bats, when they got those bats so juiced, I mean, it was crazy. We're 14, 15 years old hitting these things. Then you see on TV all these home runs getting hit. Well, then college baseball made that bat because it was getting so unsafe, but they made that bat to where they took it step aback. And so football, everything has limitations. But you opened my eyes on how there needs to be a limitation. And I don't know what it is. I think it's crazy having four transducers on the boat, but that's not me. I'm not doing it for a living. Like those guys, I do what I do. I just need one. But I don't know if it is a transducer limitation, or I think what they should do, but my thought don't matter because I'm just a guy down here in Central Arkansas. Out of the 9 tournaments, if we had 3 that was just no live scope, I think that would make everybody happy. I mean, the pros, the pros would still do it. I mean, we hear the pros were 50-50 on it almost. But like, let's have one out of every 3, no live scope. And I think that's a start. And they can compare the data of viewership too. But I mean, to just say, you have opened my eyes on it. I mean, I'm going to say, like, I mean, there's something eventually might get done. I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's enough opposition to it that eventually there's going to be some type of limitation put on it. I don't know what that's going to be. But the problem is, and I've talked about this a lot on my channel, is when the tournament organizations are being subsidized by these 7-figure, sponsorships, that is a pretty strong motivation to keep the status quo the way it is. And that's just the reality of the situation out there. And I think until that influence goes away to some extent, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them to put any limitations on it. Yep. That is one problem that I have with the whole thing over there. But mm-hmm. like I said, that's a whole another discussion with it. It's like, it's extremely polarizing in the sport right now. I mean, I'm neck deep up in it, as you know, yeah. with that. And I get all different sides with it, but you know, it's, everybody at this point, they sort of got their heels dug in one way or the other on it.
Yeah. And that's what I'm glad I'm not in the, tournament circuit, like tournament stuff like that. Now I know I use it. It's opened my eyes in a lot of ways, but like today I had somebody comment. I do some shorts where I put, or like YouTube shorts and mm-hmm. Facebook, TikToks, where you see my chest footage and then my live scope camera over it. Mm-hmm. And dude, I had somebody come after me and say, dude, you can't catch fish without it. And I was like, hey man, I went 16 years. I didn't have it, but 10 of those, I had a boat with just a 2D sonar. I never had a map or side or down. My side and down imaging was always with Johnny. And, mm-hmm. But dude, there does need to be, me as a viewer, I would love to see a smallmouth tournament without it. I'd love to see them go to this lake without it. If they went to Lake Washita, like if the Opens is going to Lake Washita, if they did that tournament without live scope, dude, like there's so many ways to catch fish there. They would still figure it out and it'd be 20 to 25 pounds a day to win. But I think it would be interesting. I mean, it would make it interesting.
That would be a good initial, you know, compromise with it to sort of get a feel for it. And, you know, eventually, I mean, my opinion, if they did that, say if half the tournaments were live scope, half were non, and they could have a correlation in viewership based upon that, and then make a decision, is this worth us to continue doing this, or do we need to go back to the old ways? Yeah, I think that you'd be surprised at the results, but that's just what happened. I've talked about this before, is, you know, you heard about the PGA ball rollback last month, didn't you? You know, they had these high tech balls that were going, you know, 30 yards further than the traditional ones before, and the PGA put a stop to it. And why it's fun to see some dude hit a golf ball 400 yards, you know, it's also fun to watch Jack Nicklaus hit it 275 yards and be really precise with it. You know, it's interesting to see how that's going to take place there. I do think that that's coming though. I do. I think the MLF and Bassmaster can only deny the reality of it for so long. And it's, I know that it's on their radar right now for sure. But it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. I'm not going to back off on it. I'm going to keep pushing hard for it. And I said, I don't mean to alienate any people that use it. I really don't. I mean, I understand that you can't compete without it. I mean, I don't make my living from tournaments anymore, so I don't have to have it. But if you're a hard charging young tournament angler, I understand that you can't get by without it. So they've been put into the position by the tournament organizations to have to do that. My counter to that, it's like given the choice, let's say if you're just some average, you know, 40-year-old bass pro, would you rather go out there and throw a buzzbait and throw a chatterbait all day long, or go drop shot a 4-inch worm out in the middle of the lake live scope? And as far as how you would rather catch bass, you know, I think most people would rather see the fish blow up on that buzzer or that whopper plopper, you know, given that. But it's almost like we sort of got there's a generation of anglers that are emerging right now that is their game, that they don't have any other game besides that, and they've mastered it, and that's why you see such a domination of the anglers now that you've never heard of before, and it's going to continue that. I mean, in 2024, you're going to see anglers win and place in tournaments consistently that nobody has ever heard of before. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, that changes, and like the younger anglers, because I know I've around some of them in college, and this is the thing that I see too with I said this for a couple years ago, because I didn't come from a family fishing background, blue collar family, which a lot of anglers I know do. But what's happening now that I see in the college fishing, high school to college, and I'm very involved with high school, is we have priced it. We have priced fishing so high. And that's fine if people getting the equipment. Like, you know, they have their money, do what they want. But it goes against those anglers that can't afford to where, like, at one time, I don't know about you, but I hear all these stories of, like, professionals, Stephen Browning, Edwin Evers, John Cruz, all these guys that, and I might have, you know, I've heard others, but I'm just mentioning some, to where, like, they grew up in the small bass boat. They didn't have the money. And they found a way. Scott Rook from Arkansas was one that, you know, I know someone that knew him. I don't know Scott, but he lived the fishing. But now to make it there, there's still people that can do it. Like, there's one angler in Arkansas right now, not going to say his name. He's dominating the circuits. If he had the financial backing to go to the Opens, he would go and compete. But he can't afford the $40,000 and all this. But there's kids I know at schools where their parents are dropping $200,000 to go to a private school like a Bethel or here, and they got the boat, and it's just like, do we really need all this to catch a fish? You know, yeah. I mean, and it's like and there's college circuits. Like, there's one college circuit, I won't name the name. I'm pretty mad at him because one of my kids I coached, he's Arkansas Tech. They got fifth in this circuit. There's like over 200 boats in this circuit. They got like $400 for fifth place, and first place was 2,000. And I did the math of how many teams were there to run that tournament. Like, you know, I did the math of the entries to what they paid out. This circuit made money, and I don't know where it went. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, they only paid five spots out of like 200. So it's just, you know, there's some money getting moved around, and I, you know, it's just, we're pricing out, I think, a lot of anglers, you know. That's why they watch YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they just want to go catch fish.
I've always said it before. It's like if I was, you know, I started fishing professionally when I was 23 or 24 years old. And that was in 1985 and 86. If I had to do that now in 2023, yeah, I couldn't do it because I did not have any money. Back then, you could do it and not have any money. You could still work a part-time job. You know, the biggest entry fees in the world were $600 of Bassmaster Invitationals. But I had a conversation last night with one of my sponsors who makes a lot of money. And he goes, and he's totally on my side with this anti-forward facing sonar. He goes, dude, he goes, I don't understand how these young guys do it. He goes, I make a lot of money. He goes, I couldn't even afford to do that. Where is this money coming from? Yeah. You know, how does somebody that's 18 or 19 years old have a brand new 3/4 ton Ford F-250 diesel with a 20, you know, 2-foot bass boat with 6 electronic units on it? It's like, he goes, I don't understand it. You know, so I think a lot of people have that question.
Yeah.
But you're seeing right. that, you're seeing those anglers emerge more. And that's one of the things that really disturbs me is you're seeing and I don't mean to say anything bad about somebody that, you know, has financial resources, but you're seeing this emergence of people that are financially privileged accelerating faster and faster to the top, where guys that are maybe from a single parent family or struggling to make ends meet, those guys don't have a chance, Jimmy. They don't. I mean, if you live in a low to lower middle income family, you can't be a professional angler when you're young like that. You just can't do it. And that's pretty disturbing to me because
And like, that's the thing. So like, what you said is true on the financial, and like now those people that come from the backgrounds, their parents, somebody did work and earn that. Me and you understand that. But like, I'm going to go back to my coaching side, to where I coached plenty of kids that came from nothing, but they did work hard. They did have some athleticism, but then they worked over, and then they would go get their school paid for or go, you know, take the step. But in fishing, like, your skill might not matter at all. Like, it just is what it is. In golf, you still got to hit that ball, you know, right? And all those. But like Gerald Swindle said it the other day on Mercer's podcast. I know Gerald sometimes don't like you. Hate to bring him up. I mean, but Gerald said it's a pay to play deal. And I'm over here like, dang, Gerald just said it. It's pay to play. And, you know, he's figured out other revenues and stuff to do. But that's only negative.
Well,
where it's going.
That's one of the things that has that's held the sport back, because let's say from a coaching perspective, like you are, say you have this 18-year-old kid that is just ate up with football. He lives it. He breathes it. He's got a rifle for an arm. He's got, you know, everything that it takes to be, you know, a professional football player. But he goes, okay, if you want to play professional football, it's going to cost you $150,000 a year, even though you have all these skills and talent. He couldn't do it. And that's sort of what the way it is with pro fishing. You can have some guy that is just born naturally talented, but if they're not in financial situation to do that, it doesn't make any difference their talent levels. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the only sport out there that's sort of like that.
Yeah, that is right. So, now, hey, I wanted to ask you one question. I know we're did you say only an hour, or do you have a little longer?
A little over an hour.
Okay, so one question I want to get this question is. You have a lot of tournament, experiences, a lot of tournament, history, memories. Right now, just sitting here, what's your favorite memory or one that stands out? I mean, you have a lot. It might be hard to do that.
Is that a good memory or a bad memory? Because
I was wanting to be good, but if it's a bad, you can share. I'll let you talk.
I'll tell you the biggest memory that I have in pro fishing, which is not a good memory, and it has affected me to this day, was the 2002 the Ranger Millennium Tournament down at the Mobile Delta. This tournament, it was one of those deals where if you won the tournament and you had some of the incentives, you'd win $1 million for first. And I had the incentives on my particular package, like the right boat and stuff like that, where if I won this tournament, I was going to win $900,000. And this was back when FLW, you fished for 2 days, and then they cut the field to 10 and zeroed the weights. Top 10 fished for 1 day. They cut it to 5, and you zeroed the weights. So anyway, the first day of the tournament down there, I came in, and I was in second place after the first day of the tournament. The second day of the tournament, I took the lead in the tournament, and I think I had like a 5-pound lead. So we went into the top 10 day, and they cut the weights down to 0. And I led it the third day. And after that third day, I had almost 15 pounds, and second place was 6 or 7 pounds. So if it had been a cumulative weight tournament going into the last day, I've got a lead of 12 or 13 pounds, right? Going into the last day. So the last day of the tournament, they cut it to the top 5 and they cut the weights to 0. And to make a long story short, I went out there, I caught the biggest bag that I'd caught all week long in about 2 hours. And I'm about 60 miles up the lake. And there was this, one of the locals was the tournament boat following me. And he goes, Randy, he goes, you just won 900,000. He goes, that's the biggest bag I've ever seen caught here, you know, this time of year. So I'm running 60 miles back to the weigh-in thinking I just won $900,000. I mean, I was convinced that I had just won $1 million in a tournament. And I get in there and there was 5 of us there. I think it was me and David Dudley and Dion Hibden. And can't remember who the other ones were with that. And I noticed one of the guys walked back to David Dudley and shook his hand. And he goes, man, he goes, that's an unbelievable day you had there. So I'm like, that's sort of unusual, no, because Dudley only had 6 pounds the day before. So to make a long story short, we get in there and Dudley beats me by, I think, 5 ounces. And I get second place in the tournament. So that's it. And the next year they changed it to cumulative weight. So in my mind, I won that tournament by 12 or 13 pounds, fished the most perfect tournament in my life. The decisions were perfect. I never lost a single fish all week. Everything was perfect. It was a week of sheer perfection. And not winning that tournament because of that is the biggest thing that stays with me. It is. And then the very next week, we had a Bassmaster Top 150 tournament at Lake Eufaula, Alabama. And Denny Brower beat me by 1 ounce. And I jumped off 2 5-pounders the last day and had 3 3-ounce shads spit up in my live well the last day. So those two tournaments... That I never recovered from that. That's the most powerful memories I've had in fishing. Something that affected me emotionally.
Yeah, and that was 2002, and then that was about the time, you know, like I mentioned earlier, where I started watching a lot. And I mean, I was young, but like right after that, and I started, you know, like you said, it affected you mentally, and I don't, you know, it's hard to overcome that. I know you're still here today, 20 years later. what would have happened, you know, if you win that, you know, and if it was cumulative weight like that, that's tough. That, like, those events, man, well, that is tough.
It, you know, that sent me into a downward spiral. I mean, I never really recovered from that. And as hard as I tried not to let it affect me, I just kept saying, it's like, you're never going to get a chance to win $1 million. And I said to myself, you actually won that tournament. I said, you know, even though it doesn't show it on paper, you won that tournament. And that I could never really shake that for some reason. And if I would have won that tournament and maybe the next one, you know, with Denny there, then that shifts you mentally. And it, and there's an internal shift that takes place that kicks you up to the next level in the sport of pro fishing. And I really felt that that is what kept me from getting knocked up to that top level, you know, to be a true one of the elite pro anglers out there. I really feel that event right there kept me from attaining that over there. It's just, it is what it is, you know.
Yeah, fishing is so mental too. Like, I mean, a lot of sports are mental, but fishing, it really is you. And it's you, and then you can't control what the fish are doing. And that mental block, when like you said, if you win those two, you're about to have the confidence of your decision-making, yeah. Everything you're doing, it's going to roll. And then even I know, like me, I don't do the tournaments, but when I'm making content or, you know, fishing like I fish, when I'm like dialed in, like this last summer, I was dialed. It was, you know, I keep thinking each year I get something better happens, but this summer was wild. And then, you know, but when I had I think about November to about December, I was in the middle of the move. I wasn't getting the fish as much. And I still caught some fish, but not like I was. And then, you know, December, I started kind of, you know, having a couple bad days. I was catching them on Lake Washita, but some of these other lakes, I just wasn't catching the quality. And it's all new. I'm fishing new lakes. And then I'm over here questioning myself, like, hey, am I doing the right stuff? You know? and then finally, you know, like I said, that mental side is there. And for you, the pro angler stuff, it's a whole nother game.
Yeah, it is. And that's what some people, you know, it's like, it's almost like I've noticed that there's some anglers, like say, for example, they cut to the top 10 where the top 10 fish the final day. Some anglers are always 10th and some anglers are always 11th. It's like, I've noticed a group of anglers and I'm sort of one of those anglers that I get 11th place by an ounce or two. And then some guys are always in that top 10 by an ounce or two. It's like, it is such a interesting study as far as just how the world works with that. Those are things I think about a lot in the tournament, or just like, you know, the 98 Bassmasters Classic, you know, I finished third in that classic and I lost a 6-pounder and a 4-pounder the second day of that tournament that would have won the tournament for me. And it's like, and one of them, I was flipping a grub next to a lay down on 25-pound line. And when I lost that 6-pounder, it's like, how in the world did that fish come off? It's like everything was perfect. I let the fish move a long time with it. The perfect hook set. And then, you know, what is it that creates that scenario, you know?
Yeah. Well, one angler you're talking, like you kind of mentioned, I think, and I just listened to a podcast earlier here when I was doing some deep dive work. I don't know him. And so I'm going to say, I think he has, and listen to him on podcasts before, I think he has the mental kind of thing down right now, was Dakota Ebear. Now, Dakota, when he started making his scene in MLF, I thought that was like he just got in and was rolling. But I looked at his history and he fished FOW for a while. He had a lot of bad years and was there, you know, and, you know, as he mentioned, he's I think he's single. I don't know if he's engaged or married, but he was living like check to check. Like there was tournaments he couldn't drive to this part of the lake because he didn't have the money. And he just kept going and going. And something up in his brain, his mental side, kept him going. And now, you know, he's been successful the past couple years. But like I said, like you said, studying people, I love kind of that as well. I always thought I was pretty mental tough. But then like hearing stories like his and seeing, like you're mentioning, like some dudes, just something about him we don't know.
Yeah.
But man, I appreciate it, Randy. This was great. I mean, this is a good podcast. Thank you for sharing some of your stories. Thank you for that last one too. I know that's tough to always kind of go through, and I appreciate it. And I know on this podcast, guys, It's on all the major platforms. I'll say that in the beginning. But I know we probably got some few of Randy's fans on here. And y'all have any comments, questions for me or Randy, leave it down below. And any last words, Randy?
Yeah, I just appreciate you having me on, Jimmy. Like I said, this whole sport, I mean, it's like I said, it's interesting how it's evolving. I'm still fortunate to be in it. And I'm pretty excited now because, as far as in it, I've sort of gotten into a different phase of my career. And it's really fun. I mean, I really like doing the YouTube stuff. Man, I really appreciate everybody that watches the videos. And I'm very grateful for that. And I feel fortunate to have like a second chance in the sport. Well, that's what sort of YouTube's done here. So I appreciate you having me on, man.
Yes, sir. Like I said, you've taken that opportunity and you're going to keep going and let's keep evolving. But appreciate it, guys. And we'll see you on the next one.